You're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks. This is our show devoted entirely to Star Trek books and comics. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as always, this week is Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how are you doing this week?
Actually doing really well, Chris. Things are great, although it did change the weather again here in Texas. Just a few days ago, it was in the 70s. Today, it was cold, rainy, and in the 40s. So,
wow,
it was a little bit of a shock to the system standing at the train station this morning.
Oh, I bet. You know, it was 2 days ago here, the forecast was sunny, and instead it snowed all day. We got about 3 centimeters of snow, which is not much, but it's a lot for us here in Tokyo. Most strangely about it is that it didn't snow all over Tokyo. It snowed only in the little area of my part of town. Very, very localized snow event, which was extremely bizarre. So I don't know if you follow my Instagram, but I took my Kirk Bear, my Spock Bear outside.
Oh, nice.
I put them in the snow. I took a picture and I said, Captain, it seems that JJ has sent us to Hoth.
Exactly. Well, you know, that I was just wondering if that had happened, or I thought maybe for some reason you had upset a queue and they were making it snow on you for no good reason. So I had no idea what was going on.
You got to be careful about those queue. You don't want to upset them.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
They're definitely not to be trifled with.
Well, Matthew, let's go ahead and jump into what is normally our news segment, but we really don't have much news this week. I think the only actual bit of news that we want to tell everyone about is an update on the release of Hive number 4, which we thought was supposed to be out this week, but it's not.
It's not. That's right. I was very disappointed. You know, I was really getting into this Atlantis storyline that we were getting. I was so excited to see what was going to happen, who is going to be the new king of Atlantis, who is going to inherit the trident. Oh, wait, that's the wrong story. I'm thinking about Justice League. We're talking about Hive. Forget me.
There's a trident there, too. So, anyway, that's why we got mixed. It's the trident.
I know. It's all confusing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know it's all confusing, but... but yeah, this is going to come out on the 27th, so we've got to wait one more week, and then we'll find out just how it all wraps up and whether we're going to get the reset button that we've talked about quite often. And I'm interested, yeah, to see how Braga concludes the story.
I do think it's going to be an interesting story end, and so like you, I'm kind of chomping at the bit at this point. I mean, we've been waiting for a long time, and so hopefully... crossing my fingers again because, well, yeah, we thought it was going to be out before, so let's get it.
One other thing that I should mention before we jump into our conversation about comics here is that this past week I did pre-order the Star Trek Visual Dictionary that DK is coming out with. It's coming out in the U.S. on the 18th of March, but I was able to order the UK edition from Amazon Japan, which was slightly cheaper. And it comes out on March 1st. And in addition to that, I did like a double pre-order, and I also pre-ordered the Okuda's book, the aboard the USS Enterprise D. So I've got to get to work on my little figures now so I can run them around in the pop-up.
You have a lot of good things coming towards you. I mean, you're going to get these books. You're going to be making these figures. Hopefully you'll get your kids involved there. You know, they can help you make the little figures and, you know, you can paint them and,
oh, definitely,
you know, do little scenes with them. So it can be just like in Spaceballs when, you know, they come in and he's like, what? No, you didn't see me. How many times have I told you to knock? You know, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't see you playing with your dolls again.
That's right. That's why I keep the door to my studio closed most of the time, because I don't want people walking in on me when I'm playing with my little Star Trek figures.
Yeah. it's probably a good idea. It's wise. Well, I'm excited about this dictionary. I think it's going to be fantastic. The TrekCollective.com has been posting these great pictures of the layouts of some of the pages, whether you talked about on the Ready Room with Greg, the Andorians. And I hope there's going to be a whole Andorian fight scene page just so we can see what moves we need to be using. Yeah.
Exactly. How-to diagrams. It shows you the moves. Exactly. That's going to be in there.
And I did want to mention too that that same website has a Enterprise's virtual tour that's going to be coming out with that book On Board the Enterprise that Mike Okuda is doing. It's a fantastic look.
The DVD with it.
Yes.
Yeah,
so,
that's going to be cool.
Yeah, these are great books. This is, again, something that we need to be supporting if we want more books like this.
All right. Well, why don't we jump into what we're going to do today instead of in lieu of news, because there's not that much news. In the feature, we're going to be talking to David R. George III. And before that, we're going to look at Ongoing number 18 and Countdown to Darkness number 2. Now, those both dropped today as we record. Of course, we had a chance to read them last week before they were released and to kind of form our impressions of what we thought about the stories. Matthew, let's just start with Ongoing number 18, the backstory of Uhura. So what did you think about these?
Well, this Uhura story for me was really interesting. You know, the McCoy storyline was very much why he did what he did in his life. You know, a great kind of overview of what makes McCoy McCoy. I thought it was interesting, you know, this comic gives us a kind of a snapshot of an event in Uhura's life. And we really don't know very much about Uhura at all. And so this is actually a huge revelation to see. But I feel a little bit cheated because I don't know as much about Uhura as I really want to from this comic. It leaves me wanting more so much because it really is. It's a very small snapshot of her life.
Yeah, I agree. That was kind of how I felt after the McCoy backstory as well. I wanted to know more. But I think we did get more in that story about the character than we did here with Uhura. The little bit of the story that we did get about her here, and I guess we should say spoiler alerts to everyone who's listening. If you haven't read these two comics, go ahead and pause and grab them. They're actually quite short. They're 24 pages each. And read through them, come back here and listen to this. Or if you're listening to the enhanced version of this show, just check the chapters and you can skip ahead to our interview with David and come back to these chapters after you get the comics. So, Matthew, the bit that we do learn about her here, I think it does do a good job of letting us know why Uhura in the ongoing comics up to this point and the Uhura that we see in the Into Darkness trailers has a much, I feel like, stronger personality, a much more take-care-of-herself attitude than we saw from Uhura in the Prime Universe. Not that the Uhura in the Prime Universe wasn't like that, but we didn't see it in the stories very much because she was always such a background character.
Yeah, you can tell and see from this story that from the beginning, even as a child, Uhura is very strong-willed. She seems to know what she wants. Seems to be very driven. She has an adventurous side to her. She kind of has a thirst for knowledge as well. So you see that in that part of the story. In the beginning of the story, we get why she's with Spock. And apparently, Uhura likes to be the aggressor in a relationship. She likes to be the one in charge, making sure she gets asked out. Or she asks out what she thinks is going to be the best suitable mate for her.
So you're using the term aggressor in this situation?
Well, I mean, you know, she seems to have planned this for a while because, you know, she says, you're no longer a part of my training. You're not my professor anymore. You're just a guy on campus. So I can go out with you now without this looking like, you know, I'm looking for favoritism or, you know, I'm trying to sleep with the professor or anything like that. So she seems to have premeditated plans for asking Spock out, which, hey, there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, she was planning to ask him out. And she makes a point of finishing her exams, you know, turning in her thesis. It's been graded. And she says, look, you know, this isn't favoritism. I'm not trying to get with you because you're my teacher or anything like that. It's all done. Now, can I ask you out for dinner? And Spock is like, fascinating. But I wouldn't call her an aggressor. I mean, it's the 23rd century, Matthew. You know, it's
well,
okay
no,
if a
I
woman
mean,
wants
you
to
know,
ask
if,
a man out.
Yeah, I mean, if I would call Spock the aggressor if he had premeditated asking her out, you know, for quite a while. It seems like Uhura knows what she wants, and she's going to go out there and get it. There's nothing wrong with that at all. I don't mean any disrespect for her being the aggressor.
But beyond this explanation, you know, of how she and Spock met and how they ended up together, I think the events surrounding her family, what happened on the ship, and, you know, obviously that would be a very traumatic event for any child. And she feels helpless. And I mean, I would be scared to death in that situation myself. My parents are unconscious. My uncle's outside the ship. Looks like the ship's going to explode. And, you know, her uncle tells her, look, I'm just asking you to drag the people that you love 5 feet. Can't you do it? And, you know, she has to dig down inside and find that strength. And I think that even though they didn't tell us much about her background, really, and this is just like one glimpse into what happened in the past, they picked a good moment. I mean, that would definitely be a life-changing experience. And the fact that she was able to get through that, I think, would give her that confidence and that strength to propel her on through her life and be the character that we are seeing so far in the ongoing comics and in the little glimpses that we have of her in Into Darkness. Not so much in the 2009 movie, but since then.
Well, I know, you know, they don't do anything, I think, by mistake in the ongoing comics. So there's definitely a reason why they're telling us this story about Uhura, you know, a few months before Into Darkness comes out. I think we'll definitely understand this much better when we see that film. It'll make a lot more sense character-wise. I think the thing that I was left kind of disappointed in, too, is that I don't really see exactly anything in here that tells me why Spock and Uhura stay together. You know, like, what is it that makes them compatible or any of those things? I don't really feel like I get that here. It's just kind of glossed over. They start dating and they're still dating. But I would love to see what is the inner workings of their relationship that actually make this something that has staying power, especially since he's a Vulcan and she's a human, and that doesn't always tend to be the easiest relationships for Vulcans to have. So I would really like, I hope that we will get to explore that more, especially after Into Darkness, which the solicitations for the comics in May have already come out, and we know that at least it looks like the entire crew will make it through the film.
Unless, like we said on the Ready Room, it's a memorial cover where we're
exactly
remembering the crew.
That's very true. Yeah. But yeah, everything's been detonated for all it stands for. So
yeah. But yeah, ongoing number 21 is going to be picking up right where the movie leaves off, they say. So that will continue it. I mean, you have a good point here. It's again, why these comics are 24 pages, they're not 32 pages. It feels like if they would make them 32-page comics, then we could go a little bit more into that story. That's what I would personally prefer to see. But yeah, I agree. I was left feeling a little unfulfilled at the end of this comic. I appreciate what we got, but it felt a bit quick. And like these things always do, and like the Bones one did too, kind of raises more questions for me than it answered, which I don't know if that was entirely the intention of them, but it's definitely something worth reading if you want to know more about the back history of the characters.
Yeah, I just felt like after the McCoy comic that I was more fulfilled with the storyline. Like, I had a better understanding. Yeah. Like, you know, I always kind of knew why McCoy left, but this just kind of gave me even more information on that. You know, with Uhura, unfortunately, we don't know a ton about her character, her past. And so any little bit, I'm just kind of left with, well, now I just want to know the rest of the story. Because there is so much more with her to find out.
I guess just knowing how she and Spock ended up dating is a question that a lot of fans wanted answered. And so that's in there.
It's true.
I will say from an artwork perspective, I think this one is very well done. Very fantastic artwork here by Claudia Balboni. And of course, we read it as PDF, but we've also read it now on the iPad. And I will say on the iPad, on the Retina display, it's absolutely gorgeous. The inking, the coloring is fantastic.
They really have done a good job with this. In fact, there's that one panel there where Spock says fascinating, and it looks, you know, spot on for Zachary Quinto's Spock. I mean, just the lighting and everything capture him as a character there. So, yes, very good job for the artists in this work. I really didn't. That's one of the things that was for me was a highlight here with some of the things I wasn't as exactly excited about.
And the explosions and the panel explosions, I mean, they really feel, it feels like they're bright and they're coming out at me from the screen. It's really excellent illustration work. Okay, well, I think the bigger one for us to talk to is Countdown to Darkness number 2. We both were blown away by the twist ending at the end of Countdown to Darkness number 1. And we've been patiently waiting a month to find out what was going to happen. And, of course, they did pick up right where they left off, as we figured they would, with Kirk standing there, along with Spock, meeting Robert April for the first time. So, what are your thoughts on Countdown to Darkness number 2?
Countdown to Darkness number 2 does a great job of continuing the story and giving me so much more to go on that all I'm wanting are issues 3 and issues 4. I think that, again, the writing here is fantastic. The artwork is superb. Everything about this comic, I feel like, is raising the bar for Star Trek comics. Even with the way that the comic really delves into the issue of the Prime Directive, too, very much getting back to the spirit of Star Trek, these deep philosophical discussions that Star Trek brings up. And this comic really harps on that issue. And I think, obviously, it's going to be very important for what we see coming up in the film. And I just was really glad to see that here because it makes me feel like I'm in one of those old TOS episodes where we're having these big discussions while a war is going on. And I can very much see Kirk, you know, struggling through this and trying to figure this out.
Yeah, we get in here one of the first big statements of the Prime Directive, I guess, at least in terms of the timeline, when April tells them, "Say it with me, gentlemen, the Prime Directive. Thou shalt not interfere in the affairs of, nor make your existence known to any civilization that has not evolved to the point of interstellar travel of its own accord." I paraphrase, of course. And then they get into, like you said, the Prime Directive here quite a lot. And Spock says, "Captain April, you committed the most egregious possible violation of the Prime Directive." And I've been speculating that scene in the Into Darkness trailer where Pike is talking to Kirk is probably related, I think, in the story to Kirk's involvement here in violation of the Prime Directive as well. I think this, what we're seeing here, is the event that they're talking about. Did you get the same impression, or do you think it's something else that's still to come?
Well, it could definitely be this, and if it is, I can make sense of that. I think the only issue for that for the film is that not everybody will have read this comic and so have any idea what they're talking about if they're not talking about something you see on screen. So I do maybe have a feeling that the 9-minute trailer that we got a while back is actually going to be what they're talking about, that Kirk is going to somehow break the Prime Directive in that situation. and put a lot of people at risk.
Now, the 9-minute trailer you're talking about is not actually a trailer, right? It's the first 9 minutes of the movie.
Exactly.
That was shown before The Hobbit. Is that right? See,
I haven't
been able to see that here in Japan personally, but...
Because they are on a world that is in the kind of the Iron Age, and that, you know, they shouldn't reveal themselves to at all. And so I'm thinking that somehow that might play in. And maybe this situation here with April is actually going to affect the way Kirk looks at the Prime Directive. Because here, Kirk is a staunch supporter. I mean, he's drunk the Kool-Aid. He's Prime Directive all the way. I have a feeling that this comic is going to kind of skew his view on the Prime Directive more to the version that we see in TOS, where he follows it, but he's also willing to kind of throw it out the airlock when he needs to.
Okay, so you think that this is not the event, but it's setting up how Kirk will react to the next situation, which is then what gets him in trouble.
I think so, but I mean, again, you know, total speculation here, so.
Sure. Well, it's all speculation. At this point, we don't know what is going on, other than one thing that caught my eye here, though, you know, we've been trying to figure out, is Robert April in the movie? And we're both, I think, certain that he's not the villain in the movie, but we know that Harrison... We don't know if Harrison is actually Khan or if he's an augment or what he is. We don't know for sure. But on this planet here where you have the same species, but of course they're different colors and they're fighting a war. But one of them is dominant over the other one. But April tells them that the rulers of the planet, although they are the same species as the people that he's supporting, that they have 10 times the aggression and 10 times the artillery. So the 10 times the aggression part, you know, it makes me wonder, I mean, because they're the same species, why are they so much more aggressive than the others? So then I keep still coming back to the idea of, you know, is there a eugenics angle to Harrison and what's going on? You know, the Klingons are going to be in the movie. If they happen to pick up any of Enterprise's history, there is the whole augment angle that played into the Klingons as well, you know, from a technological standpoint.
Yeah, so, very true.
That just caught my eye.
Yeah, this does leave me with a lot of questions. Why one part of this race would be so superior to the other in arms and, you know, superior in their abilities and their aggression and all those things. It really doesn't make sense, it seems, unless something like tampering with the DNA has gone on. And so that's a very good observation, and I'd be interested to see if that plays out at all in this, especially in the film. The other thing that I really liked about this was, and I thought was really interesting, it stood out to me, is this scene where they focus on the tricorder and this talk about technology, and Pike asks, or do holograms not exist on Earth? I stand corrected, you know, and that there's...
Well, he asks, did technology take a sudden turn backwards since I've been gone, in the particular frame that focuses in on the tricorder itself?
Which is really interesting. I'm wondering what they're trying to say here, because the hologram technology here that we see is, you know, very... the next generation Deep Space Nine Voyager type holographic technology, not something we would have seen in TOS. And so it does make me wonder, this is important. I mean, this is a scene where we're focused solely on this tricorder, this you know, little blurb of what April says.
Yeah.
I have no idea what this means.
We know from the animated series that this holodeck technology was around during this time period. It was never used on TOS itself as the show, but we didn't see it until The Next Generation. But it was, I don't know. I mean, The Next Generation, they do present it like the Enterprise D is the first ship to ever have this holodeck on it. They present it that way, even though there are references to it going back. But with the tricorder here, I really wonder, because at the end of Countdown to Darkness number 1, they make a point of us seeing this Prime Universe TOS style tricorder that April has. And then here in this comic, once again on page 9, they really zoom in on it in one frame. So they're showing us this style tricorder for some reason.
Definitely. I mean, obviously with doing artwork, you aren't drawing something that isn't important on the page. And especially in a comic where, you know, space is a premium. And so I'm very interested to see where that goes.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here.
Now, what did you think about the argument kind of between Kirk and April about the Prime Directive and where Kirk is on the Prime Directive?
Well, I think Kirk is going to be a supporter of the Prime Directive at this point because, I mean, he just came out of the Academy. It's got to be drilled into them at the Academy. It's kind of like in work or business, you know, you have someone who's fresh out of school. They're very rigid in how they view everything. You know, they've been taught, this is how you do something. I mean, marketing, you know, which is something I do. It's like, this is how you do it. It's step, 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 step. These are the best practices to do this. And yeah, that's all great in theory, but you know, it's not really like that in reality when you really
right.
become good at your trade. And so I think, you know, April, you've got a 20-year seasoned veteran, captain of Starfleet. He's seen so many things. He's had to deal with so many situations. And you've got Kirk, who's fresh out of the Academy. And yeah, he's brash and he does his own thing. And he's kind of a rebel. That's, you know, that's what I think attracted Pike to him in the first place. And he wanted to give Kirk a chance and kind of push him into Starfleet. And it's a good trait for a captain. But at this point, this is what I would expect, you know, between the two of them and how they are approaching the Prime Directive.
What I thought was interesting here is that when April is talking to Kirk, he says something that sounds very much like what Picard says to Kirk in Generations. All that matters is that you're here and you have a chance to make the difference in the lives of millions. You have a chance to save a world. And it's almost the exact same thing that Picard says to Kirk in Generations. Don't you want to make a difference? And if we know anything about Kirk in any universe, is that he wants to make a difference somehow, whether for good or, you know, in the mirror universe for evil. So I think this is a really interesting thing because it seems like this is going to be a challenge that Kirk is going to accept in some way. So I'm going to really be interested to see how Kirk kind of evolves in the rest of this comic.
Right. Yeah. Because April tells him that, you know, I saw a situation that I couldn't walk away from, that, you know, he had to do something. And I think you see that in the Prime Universe Kirk, anyway, the Kirk that we know from the movies, that, well even on the TV series as well, you know, he's a captain who, he might find a situation that he can't walk away from. He has to do something. I mean, obviously going to find Spock on Genesis is one of those where, yeah, you can't do this. And so he says, well, the answer is no. I'm therefore going anyway. You know, I can't
right.
avoid it. And so here's a case where possibly in this universe as well, this is one of those developmental moments for Kirk and how he approaches problems.
Well, just as a quick side note too, again, the artwork in this is fantastic. One of my favorite shots is the top of page 16, and it is April standing on board the bridge of his Enterprise, which is gorgeous. I love the look of this Enterprise. It captures the spirit of the new Trek with the beauty of the old Trek, and I think I almost kind of wished that JJ's Enterprise now looked a little bit more like this. I think it's perfect.
Well, you know, April's Enterprise, it's not completely because you do have one officer back there in the blue tunic. But as we were going through here the whole time, I'm looking under the jacket and I'm like, that, it really looks like one of Kirk's green tunics. It really looks like that. And then finally we get here on the bridge of April's Enterprise and we can see that. Okay, no, actually it's not. It's like it's the Abrams first uniform design 20 years earlier.
Right.
But almost everyone on the bridge is wearing the kind of the gold, the mustard colored gold like in the cage when you had Pike on the bridge and you had number one. And so I thought that was a nice little touch as well. Like you said, it does a good job of combining both.
Yeah, it's definitely really good. I also thought it was interesting that we see a character we have seen in Star Trek TOS before, but they've done a little bit of gender swapping. What did you think about having Harry Mudd be a woman and be a Bajoran?
Well, they never call her Harry Mudd. They just call her Mudd, right?
Exactly.
So we don't know, you know, she could be related to Harry Mudd, or it could be that in this universe, that's just Mudd. And the fact that she's a Bajoran, that really caught my attention. I think that caught my attention more than the gender swap, because having, here's a woman named Mudd, okay, yeah, that's fine, I get it. But Bajorans in this time period was very interesting to have that turn up. I'm kind of glad to see them do that, just because, of course, it's natural over the course of 45 years of developing the show on television, you're going to create races that no one thought about in the past, so you can't go back and change that. But you always wonder, you know, like, where were the Bajorans? Where were the Cardassians? Where were all these other races back in the 23rd century? So that was kind of a cool twist. The other one, though, Matthew, what'd you think about the fact that Robert April's first officer was named Alex Marcus?
I thought that was a really interesting turn of events, especially since we know that Carol Marcus is going to be a love interest for Kirk in the next film.
Exactly.
So it also makes me wonder, will Alex Marcus show up in the new film somehow? And whether or not that would kind of connect this story with the new movie. So I'm very interested. I mean, this comic keeps throwing things out that are just making me want more and more answers. And, you know, I don't think I'll fully get answers until the film comes out, but I'm hoping it's going to wrap up enough of the questions, so I'm not just, you know, waiting outside the theater for 3 months for the film to get here.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I expect Alex Marcus to show up in the movie or not, but I definitely do think that the first officer being Alex Marcus is here in order to lead us into the fact that Carol Marcus is on the Enterprise with Kirk. So that's a nice little thread.
I also thought it was interesting to see Uhura kind of be in command here. And I thought it was interesting that she won't sit in the chair. I don't know that's because she respects Jim too much at this point. But it does seem like that she is fully on his side. And I thought that was a great little character growth moment for her, because we do know that she is going to be on Kirk's side quite a bit in this film. And they really seem to be playing that up, that these people are growing closer as a family. And obviously we know the new film is going to be putting that to the test. So I liked seeing that little tidbit here.
It was nice, yeah. So this story is definitely one of those middle stories. I've likened it to The Search for Spock or The Empire Strikes Back in Star Wars, where it's a, you know, you're thrown into some story and then you're pulled right back out of it. You don't really have a resolution of what's going on at all. You've got Spock running off to do something. I don't know. We don't know yet. But given the trailer, and also given the trailers for the video game that I've seen, I'm pretty sure he's going to run straight down here and then jump off of something.
Yeah, I'm really hoping.
There's a lot of jumping off going on.
He's going to be practicing his cliff diving just, you know, how far he can fall without dying. What I thought was interesting here is that you get this story from April and about this people, they're being, you know, brutalized by their own kind. And then all of a sudden, Spock disappears and he's running off somewhere. And it made me think that this is going to be one of those things that connects to the 2009 space adventure film where, you know, Vulcan's been destroyed and it's had a huge impact on Spock and how he thinks and how he acts. And I think that this kind of running off to somewhere, whatever it is that he's going to be doing, is kind of motivated by who Spock has become in this new universe. And it's quite different from the Spock that we know in the Prime universe. And it's leading me to want to know, okay, what the heck is Spock doing? This week, we're very excited to have author David Orr George III with us. David has written a lot of Star Trek works, but he's also written an episode of the show itself, and so we're very excited to have him on. David, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on and giving us your time. And one of the things that's always so fascinating to me when we talk to one of the authors is to hear about their first introduction to Star Trek. For you, what was that?
Well, you know, the show's been on forever at this point, and, you know, it was in syndication for many, many years, and I grew up watching repeats of the original series and the feature films, and it just always appealed to me. As a boy, the spaceships and the aliens and the transporter and the phasers and all of that were certainly appealing, but even as a boy, I think one of the things that really drew me in was the real notion of inclusion in Star Trek. The idea that everybody deserves a seat at the table. It doesn't matter if you're black or white or green or any of the many colors, you know, black and white, as some characters were. Doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. Doesn't matter. Nothing matters. It doesn't matter what your religion is. Doesn't matter what any of the sort of superficial characteristics of human beings. Everybody deserves a chance. And that really, really appealed to me even as a young boy. And that's really sort of what still draws me to Star Trek, is that real message of inclusiveness and its other high ideals. I love the fact that the show was always about really of morality in a lot of ways, a lot of morality tales wrapped up in science fiction. And that's awfully appealing as a viewer, and especially now as a writer.
Definitely. I really enjoy that. I think about Star Trek is that it can appeal to a wide variety of people as well. You know, so many different people can like it for so many different reasons. And I think that really speaks to what Star Trek talks about, you know, infinite diversity in infinite combinations, and it really makes it a great community then to be a part of, because so many different people from so many different backgrounds all sharing the same thing, and in the end we all end up learning from each other, and I think that's great.
I do too. Star Trek is not unique in that way. I think there are other things out there that tell morality tales and that speak to high ideals. Clearly there are in television and cinema and in the literary world. But Star Trek's been doing it for a very long time. It's been doing it pretty consistently well. And it's bringing in new generations of fans. And I hope that as the new features continue, that it really speaks to those same messages, those same ideals, because I think that's one of the reasons that Star Trek has remained popular for as long as it has. People always wonder, how could this show, this simple little television show from the 60s, have lasted, you know, 50 years at this point? And I think it's pretty simple. It's the positive view of the future and appealing characters, and that's bringing people back time and time again, brings me back time and time again.
Yeah, I think it's also that you can find things in the stories 20 years later, 30 years later, because you've changed in your life. You know, you can find things in those stories that speak to you now differently than they did in the past. And so that also helps it endure that way.
I think that's a great observation, that the show, you essentially, as you grow, you can see more in the show. I think that's a great observation.
From the different series, David, did you end up having a favorite of them, or did you just kind of enjoy all different Trek?
You know, it's such a hard question to answer. I almost don't want to answer it because, I you don't want to slight your readers out there. But, you know, I have to say that the original series holds a special place in my heart because it was through the original series that I came to Star Trek. But The Next Generation really had, I think, another level of sophistication in the storytelling to it, and that was awfully appealing. Deep Space Nine turned it all on its ear, and it was filled with gray areas and an alien landscape with Deep Space Nine being the Cardassian station and all. I find something great about all the series, and you know, I can't really say that I have a favorite. Frankly, right now I've been writing a lot of Deep Space Nine. And so that sort of is what appeals to me right now at the moment. But I've also written the original series and Next Generation and Voyager. So I, you know, if I'm writing something like, if I'm writing a Voyager novel, then that'll be my favorite series.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, when you're writing a series, what is kind of your process? So you've been writing a lot of Deep Space Nine, which for me, I'm extremely grateful for, to have the complexity of your writing in the Deep Space Nine world. And one, bringing it back to the forefront again. But how do you, what is your process there for, you know, if you're writing a lot of Deep Space Nine, how do you go through the episodes and figure out which ones you want to watch? How does that work?
You know, it's interesting. It's a good question. When I first wrote Deep Space Nine, the first Deep Space Nine novel that I wrote was, actually, that's not true. I was gonna say something that's not true. The first novel, Star Trek novel I wrote was Deep Space Nine, which was a novel called The 34th Rule. But the show was still on the air at the time, and it had just completed its fourth season. And my the novel I wrote is tucked into that fourth season toward the end, I believe. I really, at that time, just paid attention, you know, to those basically the fourth season episodes. But at the time, I didn't have them recorded, or I didn't have DVDs available at the time. So a lot of it was just sort of memory and information that I got from either the show itself, from the production office, or from Simon and Schuster. But when I wrote the next novel, which was Twilight, which was one of the novels set in the ongoing storyline that carried Deep Space Nine forward from the last episode, I actually went out and got all the DVDs, and I watched the series from the beginning to the ending. And one of the things that actually amazed me when I watched it that second time was how good it was. I mean, I always enjoyed it. I thought it was a pretty good show. But when I watched it again, I was constantly amazed that I was just seeing more than I had seen the first time. But there's just so much. Actually, what I kept saying after every episode was, I can't believe the amount of humanity in that episode, that there was so right. much that spoke to the human condition just over and over and over again. And I just fell in love with it. So now when I'm writing Deep Space Nine, or actually any of the shows, depending on what the continuity is that I'm dealing with, I may pick out individual episodes that I need to watch. The one that I just finished, which is called Revelation and Dust, which is the first of it's actually not a Deep Space Nine series, but it's a crossover of various Star Treks. It's a five-book series that starts in September. Four other excellent novelists are writing the other four, Una McCormick, David Mack, James Swallow, and Dayton Ward. That's a heck of a lineup, those four. They're writing the other... I'm looking forward to it. But my novel is kicking off the series, but it's also in some ways sort of intended as an anniversary celebration of Deep Space Nine, because this is the 20th anniversary year of the show. And so I spent a lot of time looking at Emissary, the very first episode of Deep Space Nine. But I will actually go to whatever episodes I need to, if it bears on my story. Sometimes it can bear on my story in ridiculously small details, like I'll need to know whether this person's quarters had, you know, a single panel door or a double panel door. You know, I might want to write something like that, you know, just as a little nuance, and I'll need to actually go look at a scene to make sure I remember it correctly. But more often it's the complexities of a story. And I also need to check dialogue to make sure I remember things correctly. You don't always after so much time. And, you know, your memories are often colored by also, you know, what you're thinking at the time when you're watching the episode. So I always try and make sure that I have a clear grasp of the show. What's more difficult is keeping track of what's been written, because there have been, I don't know, I think 20 plus long works that have followed up from the end of the show. And keeping track of all those details that's difficult.
Yeah, that's immense, especially when you start getting to the end with, you know, some of the storylines that didn't get completely wrapped up with the Ascendants and what happens to Kira becoming Vedic. I mean, you know, the whole thing.
The Ascendants. Get Vedic Kira. Yes,
exactly.
I hear about that from time to time.
I know you do, because everybody on the boards talks about it, because, you know, they want to know what happened. But you're right. There's so many details that go into that relaunch series. It does get hard to handle. In fact, Chris and I are rereading that series from the very beginning on the show when we're not doing an interview. And it's really interesting to go back, because it's really good. It's a great series.
I love it as a reader. Forgetting even that I've been fortunate enough to be able to contribute to it, I, as a reader, love the literary works that have continued Deep Space Nine. I'm thrilled to be a part of it, but even as a reader, I'm just thrilled to be able to go and read them. But of course, if I need a detail for something, or I need to try and remember something, it can be very difficult to try. It's different than popping in a DVD and, you know, fast forwarding through a scene or something, when I have to go try and remember which book something was in and then go try and page through that book. Fortunately, I now have electronic copies of most of those works, and so I can do searches, but even that's a little tricky too. So I actually may go and do some rereading myself in the future. I actually had to do a little bit of rereading for the one that I just finished, but
but
fortunately I didn't have to reread 12 novels. And
right.
Part of the problem is not rereading all of those novels. It's rereading all of those novels in the amount of time I have to read them.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That's
most
a lot
of
work.
Time writing.
Yeah. I run into that just doing the reviews for the books, for the site itself. And, you know, when we're reading a novel on the show, you know, and trying to do my own reading and the comics. And so yes, I completely understand. You get under that time crunch. You're like, I have to finish this book.
I've been very fortunate, too, in that every now and then, I actually haven't done it in a little while, but every now and then, I'll approach a fan, somebody that I've met, a reader that I've met, maybe at the convention or even on one of the Star Trek boards or something, and ask them, hey, do you remember this detail? And do you perhaps remember where it is and exactly what that detail was? And I've had some people who have been very generous with their help in that regard. With so many Star Trek fans out there and so many Star Trek readers, we have kind of, if we want, we have a sort of a built-in research department. So I try not to take advantage of people, but every now and then they've been able to help me. I ask people if they know it off the top of their head, which, you know, I don't want people have to go digging into books any more than I have to go do it, you know.
Right. I find that if I want an answer, especially on some of the boards, I'll put it out there and Christopher L. Bennett will come up with the answer for me because he seems to know everything there is to know about Star Trek, from literary universe to, you know, Star Trek shows. And so he always ends up having an answer for me, which is great. Well, how did you, David, get into writing? Is this something that you wanted to do always, or did you just kind of fall into it, or how did that come about?
Well, virtually always. I learned to read at a young age. My mom taught my sister and me to read at a very young age, and more than that, she taught us to love reading. She just opened our eyes to the joys of reading, and so I was reading novels very young, and I wanted to tell stories as a consequence of that. And My dad actually did some editing and did some writing, and my grandfather actually wrote a novel as well, a very short novel. So I don't know if it's in the genes or whatever, but all the reading, I think, and maybe that writing heritage, it drove me to want to tell stories, you know, when I was just a boy. And as I got older, I realized, you know, I wanted to be an artist in that way. I wanted to write, but I didn't want to be a starving artist. So
right.
When I went to school, when I went to college, I studied mathematics and scientific computing, and I had a minor in writing and in philosophy and other things. But I mostly studied mathematics, and I did that in graduate school as well. And when I was gainfully employed, I finally, at last, turned my eye to writing professionally. And one of the first things I actually ended up pitching was to Star Trek Voyager, and I ended up selling that. So. With a friend of mine, so that was very exciting.
What was that like, getting one of your story ideas turned into the episode Prime Factors?
Well, you know, and that was it was both satisfying and peculiar. The whole process of pitching is at least initially, it was a very nerve-wracking experience. But it was certainly, obviously, a great to sell something. And what turned up on screen was, I was largely satisfied with sort of the main thrust of the episode is the last scene, which is a scene where Captain Janeway realizes that Tuvok, her friend Tuvok, has essentially betrayed her, has essentially violated her orders, committed an act of mutiny, really. And that was really the reason to do the episode, at least as far as I was concerned, and my writing partner was concerned. And I'm glad that at some point that got pulled out of the script, and then I ultimately got put back in. I was glad of that. But it would have been nice if that had actually played out in subsequent episodes, because that's really what we wanted, to set up this interesting dynamic. But it really didn't. But it was. You know, an interesting experience and satisfying in that way. And in a way, it sort of got me into writing the novels.
Oh, that's great. So you did your first Star Trek book was, you know, The 34th Rule. And you actually co-wrote that with Armin Shimerman because it's a Quark-centered novel. How did that work?
Well, it was interesting. After pitching to Voyager and selling the episode of Voyager with my writing partner had actually worked on the show, and he knew Armin, and he said that Armin, unlike a lot of actors, he didn't want to direct, he wanted to write. And in fact, he had written another novel. He'd written a novel called The Merchant Prince, co-written it with a science fiction writer. So Armin wanted to come up with some stories and pitch to the show. So we met with Armin, and we came up with some story ideas, and we pitched them to Deep Space Nine, to the writing staff, and didn't sell any. And we were walking out of the Hart building, which is the building in which the Star Trek offices were housed on the Paramount lot, and Armin said, you know, we should turn one of these into a novel. And I was like, yeah, right. But I ultimately called up Pocket Books, and I said, the man editing at the time was John Ordover, and I got John's name, and I talked to him, and I said, you know, how'd you like a novel from one of the actors on the show? And he said, yeah, that'd be great, but you have to go through the same process as everybody else, which meant writing a narrative outline, which told the story in broad strokes from beginning to middle to end, and also detailed all the character arcs within the novel. And then after that, if that passed muster, then we would have to write 3 or 4 chapters, maybe 50 pages, to demonstrate that we could actually write. So Armin and I spent a few weeks writing an hour television show, which actually was 42 minutes, a 42-minute script. It's a lot different than running, you know, a 100,000-word novel. So Armin and I sat down for a few weeks. The other writer wasn't interested in writing a novel. So Armin and I sat down over a course of a few weeks and belted out this much more complicated story. And I wrote up the outline, and I remember faxing it to John Ordover at Pocket Books, and 15 minutes later my phone rang and said, okay, we'll buy it. I said, well, what about the 50 pages you wanted? Eh, we understand. We just from reading your outline, we know you can write. So that was nice. So, and I'm telling the story the way Armin also tells it. There was a time when I wouldn't tell it this way, because I felt like I shouldn't, but Armin says this. So the way we were going to work was I was going to write the first chapter, and then I would hand it over to Armin, and he would make changes, make additions, make subtractions, whatever. And then we would go back forth a couple of times, and then we'd have, you know, chapter one would be done. We'd move on to chapter two. I wrote chapter one. I handed it to Armin. He called me up. He said, I love this. What do you need me for? So I actually ended up writing the 34th rule.
Oh, that's
and
great.
That's perfectly fine. I mean, I wrote the novel. He and I worked on the story together, but I actually ended up writing the novel, which was fine for me. I discovered that was my first novel. I discovered that writing by myself was a much easier way to go than writing with a partner. So that turned out to be a good thing for me. But from there, after the 34th rule, every subsequent novel that I've written, Simon & Schuster's called me up and said, hey, you want to write a Star Trek novel? So that's a really nice thing.
Yeah, that's great. And I hear that from a few of the authors, and they've had that joy of just Pocket being very interested in them again to come back and write. And I think, honestly, as a reader, what they probably like you for and what we like you for as readers is that you do great character stories. And that fits really well within, especially the world of, you know, Deep Space Nine, the character studies you did in the Crucible series. I think that it's what makes the best of Star Trek is when we get to dig into our favorite characters. And so I'm very thankful that they keep asking you back, because I know that doesn't happen for everyone.
Well, I'm certainly happy, and I thank you for saying that too. I concentrate a lot on, I would agree that my novels are largely character oriented. You know, you can have a plot oriented novel or TV show or whatever, you know, something like Law and Order. It's a procedural. It was very plot oriented. There wasn't a lot about the characters. They were just carrying the story forward. And you didn't get to know them personally, really, other than sort of superficial characteristics. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But for me, it's much more satisfying, both as a writer and as a reader, to really get into the characters and the story be a function of the characters. And they're not just getting you from point A to point B. They're changing along the way. They're facing adversity. They're overcoming adversity. They're having triumphs. They're having setbacks. So yeah, I'm glad that you think that I write good character stories, because I strive to do that.
Well, some of your latest Deep Space Nine books have kind of created a little bit of a trilogy. You wrote one of the books in the original Typhon Pack series, Rough Beasts of Empire, and then you had Plagues of Night and Rays the Dawn, and they kind of create this nice trilogy of the story of Sisko after Unity, which we hadn't seen a lot of Sisko after Unity. Mm-hmm. And you really kind of get to carry forward, because, you know, also for those who don't know, who might not have read the relaunch series, Deep Space Nine was behind all of the other relaunches they did, and so Deep Space Nine kind of jumps time. And there's a kind of
four years.
Yes.
We just gotten into 2377, and then the following book was in 2381. So yeah, we jumped 4 years ahead.
So you have a lot of Sisko's life there that, you know, we don't really know too much about. So Rough Beasts of the Empire there is a hard book for Sisko. He is dealing with a ton of things, and a lot of fans reacted really strongly to that. For me, it was difficult to read my favorite character be so crushed. But once I read, obviously, Plagues of Night and Rays the Dawn, everything makes sense because it works together as this trilogy. But how did you kind of come up with what the next steps for Sisko were going to be, kind of out of that 4 years of silence?
That was an interesting process, and it's interesting how some of the reactions have been interesting to the novel, to the series of novels, but especially Rough Beasts of Empire. And I actually expected some of the sort of blowback that I got on it. It's very interesting. Here's the thing about Sisko. Actually, here are a few things about Sisko. First of all, I love Ben Sisko. I think he's a great character. He's so easy to write. I have no problem getting inside his head, and he's just a fascinating figure for so many reasons. But the way he was drawn from beginning to end in the television series just made him such a complex individual, and that's just a blast to write. So when I got Rough Beasts of Empire, I was asked to do two things. I was asked to jump the series ahead 4 years, and I was asked to get Ben Sisko back into Starfleet. Now, the thing is, you're right, after Unity, we didn't have a lot of Ben Sisko, and the character was sort of just on Bajor with his wife, Cassidy, and with his daughter, Rebecca, and essentially, I guess, in retirement, really. And as a reader and as a fan, for me, that was very satisfying, that his arc had sort of come to an end and that he was just essentially living happily ever after. I liked that.
Right.
I know that everybody liked that. I think as fans of the show, people wanted Sisko back. I can understand that. I have no problem getting Sisko back. I wasn't sure how you could get him back into Starfleet. Certainly, I wasn't sure how you could get him back onto Deep Space Nine in any real believable way. I mean, at that time, Kira was a captain and the commanding officer of Deep Space Nine. How do you get Ben Sisko back there and had it be actually believable and satisfying? And then there's this question of the 4 years that we don't see. We had the big Ascendance storyline that was proceeding forward, and we seem to be right on the verge of heading into whatever that conflict is, and then all of a sudden it's 4 years later. Now, I have the choice of either ignoring it completely, spending a few pages, since I'm not telling that story, I could spend a few pages saying what happened, or neither of which are very compelling courses of action as far as I'm concerned, as a writer or as a reader. Or I could do what I did, which is seed little hints about what happened in the hopes that that story would ultimately be told. As far as getting Sisko back into Starfleet, how do you do that? Well, I mean, we could keep him as the emissary, but it seemed to me that we trod that ground a lot. I mean, we the whole series, and then, you know, we had the whole sequence leading up to Unity in the novels. Seems like that. To me, the story of Sisko reaching the end of his being the emissary had played out for us. So I focused on, you asked me what episodes I looked at. I looked at a lot of episodes before I wrote that novel. A lot of episodes starting with the one in which the prophets tell him if he spends his life with Cassidy, he'll know nothing but sorrow. And that, to me, was a loose end from the series that never got resolved. So I thought, let me take this and resolve it. Let me show that you know, you'll know nothing but misery. Let me show that. Let me show what's happening. And so I glommed onto that detail, and I tried to draw a big story out of it for Sisko. And it was, I mean, I also like to challenge myself as a writer. I like to up the degree of difficulty. And I knew I would face some opposition with Sisko fans. And some people say I drew Sisko in a way that was not consistent with the character we saw on the show. But I beg to differ because I watched those episodes again and again. And there were episodes, there's The Reckoning, where a Pawraith inhabits Jake and a prophet inhabits Kira. And they're about to do battle against each other, and Ben Sisko has the option, he has the ability to stop that conflict from happening, to stop that battle. But he doesn't. He chooses not to. And he's rooting for the Prophet, which means he's rooting against the Pawraith, who's inhabiting his son. Seems to me like Jake might end up dead from that. So this is what this character did. He risked his own son's life. There's the episode where he risks his own life trying to experience these visions he's having. He wants to experience them so that he can understand the plan that the prophets have. And he's risking his own life. And if he dies, he abandons Cassidy. He abandons his son. So this character has done things in the past, done things on the series itself, that demonstrates that sometimes, even ahead of family, he follows the prophets. He'll do what he thinks they want him to do. And so I didn't feel like I was drawing a different Sisko in Rough Beasts of Empire than we had seen previously. Some people disagree, but I love the character. I was scrupulous about trying to draw the same person we'd always seen. And one of the great things I think about Deep Space Nine is that there's a lot of gray. These people are heroic, but then you have Sisko doing what he did with Garak in The Pale Moonlight, when they bring the Romulans into the war in what is not exactly the most moral of ways. So, you know, there's, like I said, a lot of gray in Deep Space Nine, and that's fun to play with as a writer. And for me as a reader, it's fun to read that too.
Yeah, and I liked the way that, you know, the continuation of Sisko being a very deep, thoughtful person. You know, he doesn't really do things very rashly. He's always trying to figure things out and do the right thing. He has a strong moral compass as a center. And, you know, he also has this faith, which is very different for a lot of people in the 24th century to understand. And that drives him as well. And I think that's what made him such a compelling character.
It's not something you see a lot of times on television, everything we dealt with in the Bajoran faith and how Sisko reacted to it. There's another component of Sisko in Rough Beasts of Empire, too, which is this. Some people thought, you know, that Sisko was now a deadbeat dad and all of that kind of thing. But here's the question. The real question at the very base of every action Sisko takes in Rough Beasts of Empire, if you were told that for a fact, if you stayed married to your wife, something terrible would happen to your daughter. But if you left them, they would be fine. What would you do? I mean, this is not, it's not as though the prophets are predicting something. We're given to understand that the prophets are nonlinear, that their future is the same as their past, that it's all of their existence wrapped up into one. And they're telling Sisko something that they see. They see that if this is what you do, then this is what will happen. How do you react to that? What do you do? I mean, if you fight against it and then they die, if Cassidy and Rebecca die, how do you get back from that? How do you survive that?
Yeah.
To me, it was a compelling question of how to deal with it. And you know, Sisko didn't exactly say, okay, I'm going to bolt, and was happy about it. He wasn't happy about it. He didn't want to leave his wife and daughter, but he thought he had to do so for their own safety. To me, that's the moral thing to do. I mean, I guess. I mean, it's a very difficult moral question. It really stems from whether or not you believe 100% that something, or even 99% that something bad will happen if you don't leave. And we've seen that he believes the prophets.
Yeah, and I like, too, that, you know, the series has given us reason to believe along with Sisko that he has a good reason for believing the prophets. It helps when you're born of them, I think.
Yeah, when you're part prophet, it kind of helps.
It does. It's like, yeah, you know, mom said, you know, I'll believe it. It's got to be true.
Well, you know, he's had, you know, the prophets, as you say, have given him reason to believe. And it's sort of different than the notion of, say, a 20 or 21st century humanity believing in one god or another, because these are beings with whom he's had contact, actual contact. And you can ask the question of what makes a god and all of that, but they certainly exist in a different way than he does, than humanoids do, and they've been able to demonstrate great power and great ability to know the past, the future, to link it all together. To me, it was all a fascinating landscape on which to see stories told, and then I'm so fortunate to be able to tell some of those stories myself.
Well, you know, after that book ended, wasn't sure, you know, as a reader where, you know, Deep Space Nine was going to go next, and I was really excited when they decided to allow you to tell some very Deep Space Nine centered stories. I mean, they were labeled under the Typhon Pact series, but really these are Deep Space Nine books, Plagues of Night and Raise the Dawn. So you not only got to pick up on the Sisko storyline, but you took all of the political machinations that you had seen through the other Typhon Pact series, from the Romulans to the Breen to the Zenkathy, and you put all of them into the same story. I don't know how you did it, because it's one of the most intricate Star Trek stories I've ever read, with everything that's going on. What?
It's a bit busy.
It really is, but it keeps me... Oh, man, I was turning the pages like crazy, trying to get to the end to see how this was all going to work out. What was your motivation and inspiration for this kind of duology that really kind of completes the storyline you started with Sisko in Rough Beasts of Empire?
Well, you know, when I wrote Rough Beasts, I started Sisko on this arc, and all the arcs we've seen actually back in the TV series, but then also in the books that followed the series, don't all resolve in one episode or one novel. Some do, but plenty of them seed storylines moving forward. And I had always envisioned Sisko's storyline continuing, and I had in mind what I would do, but I had no guarantee that I was going to be writing the next Deep Space Nine novel. I was fortunate to be able to do that. So I had an idea for Sisko for these two. I was offered two books, and basically the two book series, and I had an idea for what I wanted to do politically, and it really required me to draw all of the Typhon Pact stories together. That's what I needed to do, and so that's what I tried to do, just to try and make one whole cloth out of the different pieces that we'd had made so far. And I wanted, for various reasons, it was my editor and I wanted to approach Deep Space Nine in a way that if there was never another Deep Space Nine novel, this was a good way to end it. And yet, if there were more Deep Space Nine novels, this was a good way to restart it. So those were the ideas that I had in mind. Those were the goals that I wanted to fulfill. And I really enjoyed writing those books. I've been writing, as you say, a lot of Deep Space Nine, and that's been a lot of fun. And in fact, the one I just finished, which will be out in September, is the new Deep Space Nine, which is also a lot.
Yeah, I am chomping at the bit to read that, because I really want to see what happens next in the story of Deep Space Nine.
I want to look forward past that to the next one, but there's no guarantee that there will be a next one. I would say for all those Deep Space Nine fans out there, this is going to sound very self-serving, but I really mean it sort of not just as a writer, but as a reader. If you want there to be more Deep Space Nine, if you want there ever to be a chance of there being an Ascendance story, telling everything that happened, buy these I'm not the only one who has Deep Space Nine elements in their story in the fall. There are other books too. Buy these books. Support these books, and that's the way that they'll go forward. Because Deep Space Nine's sort of always on the cusp, you know? I think that might be why we haven't seen Deep Space Nine on a book. We see Star Trek Typhon Pact, and yet it happens to really be a Deep Space Nine novel. If you want there to be more Deep Space Nine books, if you ever want there to be a chance for the Ascendant story to be told, buy these books. I know that's self-serving because I wrote one of them, but still.
Oh, but it's a good point.
No, I promise to make people buy them because I will use the platform I have to make people buy them.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, forgetting about it, even if I don't get to write another one, as a reader, I want them to go on because I really have enjoyed what all these other writers have done as well. It's just been, and what Marco has done and Margaret Clark, and it's just Marco Palmieri who started the Deep Space Nine relaunch, and Margaret Clark who has continued with it, Ned Schlesinger. It's just been great. It's been great as a reader. I mean, I really love following these characters.
One of the interesting things is, in these two books, we talked about a little bit, you do get to bring Sisko full circle as emissary, and that, his path as the emissary gets to be complete. It gets to be finished. Do you have any idea where that might leave him just as a, you know, a follower of the prophets now? And I do
have an idea.
Okay, good.
And you see, the thing too is, it's not as though storylines in the television series didn't get wrapped up. I mean, there were certainly loose ends, but you know, Odo went back to the Dominion and back to the Great Link, and Kira took over as the commanding officer. I mean, there were storylines on the series that got wrapped up. Sisko ascended to the Celestial Temple, and if this was the last Deep Space Nine we ever had, if there were no books, there was nothing afterward, some of these storylines got wrapped up, and that's where they would be. And now, you know, Sisko has essentially run his course as emissary. Again, we could go back and retread some of that, but I think it might be more interesting to take him forward somewhere, take him to someplace different. Doesn't mean he won't ever come back. It's a storytelling is a process. And particularly when you have novels that are telling the story of an ongoing series, you don't have to wrap everything up. And certainly one of the hallmarks of the series was change. You know, Dr.
Exactly.
Bashir is a young, brash, naive man. Except, no, he's actually genetically engineered and superhuman. Oh, okay. I mean, the show changed on a dime. And I think Marco and Margaret, all the editors and writers, have done a good job in the series of books keeping that alive, keeping the notion of ongoing stories and frequent changes and not being able to know where something's going. They've kept that alive, I think, pretty well. And I'm speaking, again, as a reader myself.
Well, a lot had changed in Deep Space Nine. We talked about, things we didn't get to see. Certain characters had moved on to different positions. For you, especially in this series again, how did you made it feel very natural, which, you know, you said was a struggle, especially with Rough Beasts of Empire, to do. But again, when you read Plagues of Night and Raise the Dawn, I don't see Kira being a Vedic is like, what? Why is this happening? It kind of feels like a natural extension of somebody who's spent her whole life fighting, becoming somebody who would devote herself to the spiritual life. How did that come about?
Well, you know, she was strong of faith her whole life. And yes, she was, you know, the first quarter century of her life she was under an occupying force and fighting that battle, and then she comes to Deep Space Nine and she's still fighting the Cardassians in one way or another, and fighting all sorts of other things, fighting herself, fighting her prejudices, all of these things. And so when we were leaping forward 4 years from the Soul Key to Rough Beasts of Empire, the question is, okay, who's going to be staying in place, who's not moving? Well, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for nobody to be changing in those 4 years, because that's not what the show was, you know?
Right.
So I had to think, okay, I started with Ben Sisko because that was, you know, one of the things I was given to do was get him back into Starfleet. The second thing is, okay, where's Kira? And to me, all right, we're leaping forward. We're now in 2381. So Kira's, you know, 35, 36 years old, different than being 20 or 25 when the television series started. Maybe she's growing up. Maybe, you know, maybe she's finding some peace. Maybe she's, you know, moving on. So I think making her a Vedic was an interesting choice. If I didn't think it was interesting, I wouldn't have done it. There are probably other choices that could have been made. This is the one I made because this is something I thought would be interesting to explore. And I don't think that Kira, I know Kira's arc hasn't, as a Vedic, has not been explored. It hasn't been explored how she quite got there. I mean, I think it's understandable how somebody of such a strong faith could eventually get to that position where they enter essentially the priesthood. But so that story hasn't been told. But also going forward, well, let's explore what this is going to mean to Kira. And we saw a little bit of that in, I think, Raise the Dawn. But I think there's still plenty more to explore. And Kira's also a great, great character. I love Kira.
Yes. Yeah, she has one of the, we've talked about on our show, The Orb, which Chris and I do. It's dedicated to Deep Space Nine, so we just talk Deep Space Nine all the time. But we talked about how next to Sisko, Kira probably has the best arc of anyone in the show. Yeah. And it's so compelling.
Well, I agree, both in the series and actually in the books too. I thought what Marco and the writers did with her attainder, her being essentially excommunicated for a while from the Bajoran religion, what a genius thing to do.
Right.
What a great idea that was, because, I mean, this is the ultimate adversity you can give to a person of faith, is that, okay, you have this faith, but you're now no longer allowed to practice it with all of the other people who share your faith. It's fantastic. I mean, there is no drama without conflict.
Exactly.
You need conflict, and that conflict can come in any number of ways, but it's always fascinating when our heroes have to face things like that. At least, I mean, that's how I feel about it.
Well, you know, this series, you actually destroy Deep Space Nine.
Spoiler alert!
Exactly. And it was sad to see it go. You know, I don't know why I loved the Cardassian monstrosity so much.
I do. I know why you loved it. You probably loved it for the same reason I loved it, because this was, again, Michael Piller and Rick Berman created Deep Space Nine, and Michael especially was so gifted at creating a really textured landscape upon which to draw stories, and he really did that exceptionally well with Deep Space Nine. The whole notion of the Bajoran religion and the occupation and all of that, Sisko's backstory, the loss of his wife, raising his son as a single parent, all great stuff. And part of that was this actual physical setting, which was different than anything we'd ever seen before. Oh yeah, we might see an alien spaceship, an alien space station, whatever, but we never lived in it. We never existed there, and to have our characters essentially, initially at least, fighting their environment, it's a fascinating thing. And I'm still amazed, looking back. I ended up pitching, I wrote a narrative outline for Plagues of Night and for Raise the Dawn, and in those outlines, the end of the first outline was the destruction of Deep Space Nine. And I was just waiting for the phone call that told me, yeah, no, you can't do that. You see, the show is called Deep Space Nine, so we kind of need one of those. But the people with whom I work, in this case it was Margaret Clark and Ed Schlesinger and at Paramount, or not Paramount, CBS, John Van Sitters, there's some creative people, and they see very often the advantages of certain storytelling ideas. And again, Deep Space Nine was nothing but change in the TV series itself. So why not keep that going? And to me, it wasn't just a gimmick. I didn't do it because, okay, let's just do it. It served the story I was trying to tell. But I still am amazed that nobody said, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, I feel like that the destruction of Deep Space Nine fits in the same way that Kirk destroying the Enterprise in 3, you know, works for me, because it feels organic to the story. It's not just, oh, we're going to destroy a ship like they did in Generations. We want a new
one. Yeah.
So we'll have Troy crash it. It'll be fine. Everybody will laugh.
We need a ship that'll look better on the big screen, so let's get rid of this one. That was...
Yeah.
Well, Deep Space Nine, Tarek Nor, has actually essentially been a character in the show and in the books.
Yeah.
So
right.
It's essentially the death of a character. So now you have, you know, what do? Do you replace that character? And, you know, I actually wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. I mean, I knew I was going to build a new space station, but I didn't know I wasn't going to call it Deep Space Nine A. And there was already a Deep Space 10. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but everything that happened sort of happened, as you used the word just a few minutes ago, organically. And that's the way stories should be told. You don't try and force things. When you try and force things, it doesn't turn out well. It's bad enough when you don't force things and they don't turn out well, but when you force things, they never turn out well. So, I'm among a very small number of people who have been on the new Deep Space Nine. I'm very excited about it.
I cannot wait to see what the station looks like. So, yeah, I just want the cover art to come out so I can know what it looks like.
Well, nobody said it was going to be on the cover.
Yeah. Well,
nobody said it wasn't.
Yeah. Hopefully they'll give us a pullout then with, you know, an awesome poster.
Yeah, I don't know. I have hopes for how people will be introduced to Deep Space Nine, but at the very least, you'll have a picture painted in words. At the very least.
Yeah. I was thinking too, you could do it in the Star Trek magazine. You could give us a nice poster in that. You know, that works. So, because I want it on my wall.
You're not the only one. I've had some talks with my editors about such things, and you know, of course, everything comes with a cost. You know, I mean,
that's true.
You know, they have budgets and they have to deal with what they can spend on things. But I'm hopeful that ultimately we'll get to actually visually see Deep Space Nine, but at least we'll be able to read Deep Space Nine. And
yeah,
I've had fun on the new station.
Yeah, you should hook up with our friend Sean Taranjo, who did the Titan for the Titan series. He draws just fantastic ships. Pocketbook should hook up with him again and get that vision of the station going.
Well, I'm not in the business of hiring, but I'm in the business of saying, hey, why don't we do something like this? So I'm not sure. I have an idea of what's happening, and I'm hopeful for what we might see in the future. But who knows? Like I said, the best way to get any Deep Space Nine in the future, whether it be books or cover art or posters or Star Trek magazine articles and artwork, is for these things to actually sell well. I really hate saying that because I sound like a salesman and I don't like that, but I love reading these novels. Love writing them too, but I really want to keep reading them. So I hope that that will keep happening. I hope that these books will do well. Like I say, I'm not the only one with Deep Space Nine elements in this 5-book series that's starting in September. There are others who will visit Deep Space Nine elements, so hopefully people will get those as well. It's a great lineup. I mean, Una McCormack and James Swallow, David Mack and Dayton Ward are all, in my estimation, just terrific writers.
Yeah, they are, and we've gotten to talk to them all.
Yeah, we've had all of them on the show here.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so they have been fantastic.
I've listened to a couple of your episodes. I listened to Dayton's and Kirsten's, and I need to listen to the others. Have they teased the fall at all?
They have, actually. And so, in fact, when we talked to Una, we had the grand idea that once Dayton's book comes out, I think next January, we should try and get everybody on one huge podcast.
Wow.
So we could talk to all of you together and just let y'all, we'll just ask a question and then we'll throw it out there for the wolves to just like, you know, go at.
Well, all that requires is good timing since Una and James are in the UK.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And I'm in Tokyo, so.
Oh, really?
We're spread out everywhere, yeah.
And Dave Mack is on the East Coast.
Exactly.
Dayton's in the middle of the country, and I'm on the West Coast. But,
yeah. Hey,
I'm all for it. You know, we've had, when we started with the Typhon Pact, the first four novels, David Mack and Dayton Ward and Mike Martin and me, we've had conference calls. You know, we've got on the phone at the same time and beat some ideas around, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet. David, I wanted to ask you, you know, you destroyed Deep Space Nine, but by the end of Raise the Dawn, you bring back its core by allowing some characters to kind of come back into the fold. Miles comes back, which I couldn't be more excited about because him and Julian belong together forever as friends. You know, Odo is back. He's trapped now because of the wormhole being closed right now. You have Sisko, who's back in Starfleet. We're not quite sure, you know, if he'll be involved with, you know, anything with Deep Space Nine. I've got my fingers crossed, though. So for you, was that kind of the plan to kind of rebirth this series?
You know, it was and it wasn't. It was certainly, and same thing I mentioned earlier, it was a way to try, I certainly wanted to try and cap the series if this was going to be the end, because it was unclear whether it was going forward or not. But I also wanted to set the stage for it to actually continue going forward. And I knew there was going to be a new station. I knew it wasn't going to happen overnight, you know, that there had to be a process and that there was a story in that. But as far as, as far as bringing back characters, you know, when the series ended, so many people were gone. Worf was gone. Miles was gone. Nog was gone. Wait, was Nog gone? Where was Nog? No, Nog was still on the
station. No, Nog was there.
Odo was gone. Worf was gone. O'Brien was gone. Sisko was gone. I mean, just, you know, the cast was gutted. The cast of characters was gutted. And so when we started telling stories again in the books, we could have brought everybody back, but that would not have been very compelling, I don't think. I don't think you could have done it in a way that was very reasonable. Now, at the end of Plagues of Night, it's 2383. So it's, you know, 7 years after the end of the series. 8 years after the end of the series. So I think at that point, bringing some characters back no longer seems like, oh, they're just trying to undo things and they're doing it in an unnatural way. I think it happened sort of very organically. I thought I was going to bring back Miles. I didn't know about Nog, or maybe it was the other way around. And it just became a natural thing to do as I was writing the book. And actually, Odo was a decision I made almost in the 11th hour, almost at the last minute of writing. I didn't really plan to have Odo in the Alpha Quadrant, and then it seemed just like the right thing to do. And especially because we were building a new station, not that Odo would want to go back to the station, but I mean, the character. You have to be true to the characters, too. But let's put him back there and see what happens. And now it's interesting because Kira seems lost, the wormhole is gone, Odo seems trapped. It's all, you know. So, I mean, there was intention there, but it was part of an organic storytelling process that allowed me to bring those characters back, too. And even though Ro was not a part of the television series, not part of Deep Space Nine, she'd been in the books from the beginning. You know, from the beginning of our relaunching the show in book form. And so she's there, and she sort of feels like, you know, a part of the ongoing cast. And now we have some new characters, and they've been through some books now, and so we're going to get to know them. I think it's, I don't know, I hope that it's organic. I hope that it feels right. It feels right to me to have Miles back and to have Nog back. And Odo as well. And the book that I write, the book that I've written, that people will read in September, goes a long way to launching the four books that follow it. But it also hints at things to come. You know, it resolves a couple of things. You know, it's basically, you know, I hope it's just not just an episode, but I hope it's another, you know, installment of the series that satisfies people and that give them their fix of Deep Space Nine. Certainly gave me mine, but it takes me a long time to write these.
Yeah, well, and I definitely have my fingers crossed that I want people to be buying these books. You know, if you haven't read Plagues of Night, Raise the Dawn, Rough Beasts of Empire, and you love Deep Space Nine, please get these, read them. Like, you know, you said, David, you're not going to get any more Deep Space Nine if they don't sell, and this is a fantastic series.
Yeah, and I'm not just talking about I'm not just trying to sell my books. I mean, like I say, other people in the fall, in the series, the
right,
fall.
Right, exactly.
Which is actually out this fall, are Deep Space Nine related. So, you know, it's important to support them as well.
Right.
And it's important to support them. I mean, I guess, you know, the Star Trek books aren't going away right now, but Deep Space Nine may be on the cusp of going away. It's not, you know, things need to sell well in order for them to, you know, keep being published.
Well, and I want to say too, you know, Deep Space Nine, without that relaunch, I don't know if Star Trek books would have been as popular, because I think it started a whole new way of looking at the Star Trek book series, of relaunching the show. And it was so successful for Pocket, and has done so well. I really do hope that it will be given another chance to be continued. And
well, you know, it's a double-edged sword, because, you know, from a creative standpoint, I agree with you, spectacularly successful. It was fantastic. But also, it transpired was it also became kind of daunting for some readers who wanted to jump in.
Right.
Right.
Right? You know, I mean, it's like a serial television show. You know, there's some television shows where you can pick up in any season and just watch an episode and be fine. And there are other TV shows where you pick it up and you have no idea what's going on. And so, you know, there's a trade-off in doing a continuing series like that. So, you know, we're striving, though, to tell entire stories. And this has always been the case. You want to be able to, you don't want a reader, it's okay to leave them hanging, to leave them wanting more, but it's not okay to tell a story and not have a resolution to it. You know, you can leave some threads unresolved, but the basic plot of a novel you want to have resolved in. You want the reading experience of one book to be satisfying in and of itself. But it's certainly okay to seed other plot points, you know, for future storytelling in as well. And, you know, I'm going to go back to what I've been saying all interview, which is, as a reader, I am anxious to see the books continue, see Deep Space Nine continue. And, boy, I sure would love the Ascendance storyline to get wrapped up.
Me too. Well, I do want to move us to your brand new book, Allegiance in Exile, because this is a great book. It's in the TOS era. You set this one in the fourth year of the first 5-year mission. And it really gives two different characters a chance to shine and kind of really connect them to where they're going to go next. You know, Kirk and Sulu. What made you choose that time period and those two characters to kind of spotlight?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was asked to write an original series novel almost at the last second. It was kind of a surprise, and it was like, I love the original series, so that's not a problem, and I love all the characters, but especially Kirk. But I thought, what am I going to do? What do I want to talk about? What I want to see. What don't I know about Kirk? And I'm not sure what there is that I don't know about Kirk. Not just because, you know, I've seen these episodes so many times, but how many books have been published? Original series books have been published since then. But to me, that because we didn't see it in the series, that last season, on last year of the mission, would be interesting. And I know there have been books that sort of followed the interregnum between the end of the 5-year mission and Star Trek, the motion picture, that two and a half year period. And I wanted to try and just explore, you know, Kirk, and you know, it's not like he wasn't melancholy at some times through the show. And he was always contemplative. I mean, people talk about Kirk as the man of action, and certainly had his share of fist fights and phaser fights and all of that. But he was always very contemplative too. And it seemed to me that he was always wounded by his crew being hurt, and he wore that responsibility very heavily. Mm. So I just wanted to explore that. And Allegiance in Exile is kind of a different sort of a novel for me, because it doesn't have I like to write very complex stories, and Allegiance in Exile is a sort of a simpler story, and it really is trying to be a character study of Kirk and Sulu. And at first, I just sort of set out to explore Kirk a little bit, and Sulu just sort of happened, as we've used this word a few times, organically. It just, as I was writing the outline, this sort of just appeared to me, and we haven't seen a lot of Sulu. I mean, we didn't in the original series, so I thought it would be an interesting character to explore, and I tried to explore him in a way, in a story that we really haven't seen before, which was, you know, dealing with difficulties in his romantic relationship, a certain type of difficulty. I haven't read all however many 700 novels of Star Trek, but I don't think we've seen something like that. At least I haven't, certainly not on the shows. So I wanted to explore that a little bit. And it really, to me, leads into the novelization of Star Trek the Motion Picture and Star Trek the Motion Picture itself. But in the novelization, you have the character of Lori Chiana, who Kirk, who features in Allegiance and Exile, and who Kirk has actually, according to the novel, Gene Roddenberry's novelization of Star Trek the Motion Picture, is a 1-year marriage with.
Oh, wow.
Between the end of the 5-year mission and the beginning of Star Trek the Motion Picture. So I think it's a book that actually might serve readers who are really steeped in Star Trek lore better than people who are not, because it really does play against, I tried to make it play against what came later. So it's really, I tried to imagine the end of the 5-year mission and just really lead into what was going to happen in the couple of years that followed before Kirk got back on the Enterprise. So that was my motivation for the story.
I thought that that was really interesting because you do have Kirk kind of in that beginning of the melancholy that will happen in the motion picture where he is not happy being an admiral. And he begins to worry about this beforehand. And I thought that that was excellent to see the genesis of the man you'll see in the motion picture. And it explains it really well. I mean, you know, we know that Kirk's best destiny is starship captain. And as Spock said, anything else is a waste of material.
Mm-hmm.
A
man who knows really, the dialogue.
Yes. I really appreciated that you showed me how Kirk could get to that point. Because, you know, in the motion picture, it seems very strange to go from Turnabout Intruder to, you know, the motion picture. And you're like, well, that's not the Kirk that I know.
Well, you know, there's like a 4.5-year gap between those
right.
two events. So
exactly.
You're left to imagine. But, you know, Kirk was always one for introspection, though, certainly in the first season especially, but even in the second season, not as much in the third. But, you know, one of my favorite scenes in the original series is in Balance of Terror when he's deciding, you know, whether to violate the neutral zone, the Romulan neutral zone, in his pursuit of the Romulan ship that destroyed the outposts. And, you know, he's worried about starting a war. He's worried about not stopping this ship and then allowing a war to start by inaction. And, you know, he has a scene, there's a scene with Kirk and McCoy in Kirk's quarters. And Kirk talks about it very quietly and very, in a way of self-examination, he says, you know, I look at all those people on the bridge looking at me, waiting for me to make the decision on what to do, and, you know, what if I'm wrong? So it was not like Kirk was not somebody who was introspective. He was. And so I tried to weave that in and tried to bridge that gap between the end of the series and the motion picture. And also, you know, I have Kirk actually sort of trying to talk himself into what might happen.
Right.
You know? And which I think is what people do sometimes. This might happen or that might happen, but you know what? Whichever thing happens, I'm going to be happy. I'm going to make it the right choice, whatever happens to me, you know? And it's a real human thing to do, I think. And it's really, I think motivations are really, really important for characters, to keep characters true to themselves, but to also have them be very human. You know, even our heroes should be human. Even our heroes should have failings. It's
right.
sort of uninteresting. It's like having a supervillain who's just evil. Well, that's kind of boring. I mean, let's, you know, show me why you're doing this. Show me that you don't think you're evil. Show me that you're doing this for a good reason, even though when I look at it, I think it's evil. I want to know that you don't think you're evil. I want you to be the hero of your own story, even if you're a villain. That's more interesting. It's more interesting to have heroes who have failings. It's also more realistic.
Yeah. So like John Harrison in the new film and detonating Starfleet and all it stands for.
Yeah.
He seems to definitely have an opinion that he's doing the right thing.
That's what they've suggested.
You should absolutely. I think villains should always be that way, unless they're just, you know, insane. And every now and then you need an insane villain, I suppose. But the more interesting villains are the ones with good motivation, even if you think it's the wrong motivation, even if it is the wrong motivation, if it's an immoral motivation, it should be realistic and it should be driving them, you know. And it's like, you know, I wrote a Harriman novel. John, you know, an Enterprise B novel, and we got to see only a little bit of Harriman in Star Trek Generations, and he seemed a little inept. And the question is, how does somebody like this become the captain of a starship? Well, you know, I tried to really paint a picture of how this could happen and why this could happen and who this man really was. And, you know, you always want to try and flesh out these characters and make them realistic. It makes for better reading. It makes for better viewing if you're talking about movies or TV series. And I also, just for my own selfish writerly needs, I also made sure that I left enough time here and there in Allegiance and Exile so that it fit in nicely with Crucible, my Crucible trilogy, which was the other original set of books that I wrote. I left a little... because in that series, in the Crucible series, I dealt with the last mission of the last mission that the Enterprise had in the 5-year mission under Kirk, and so I left in Allegiance and Exile. I specifically left time for that to happen.
Oh,
I didn't want to contradict myself.
Well, you do. And we talked about it a little bit, but I just wanted to ask you. You know, you tackle those questions of command and the burden that it is, and the kind of the juxtaposition of where Sulu is and where Kirk is as a character. And what do you think, you know, you talked a little bit about Kirk, but what do you think that is about him that makes him so good as a captain? I mean, because some of the things that he talks to Sulu about, you know, he has thought deeply about these issues, and he just has this strong conviction that he can make the right decision. And he will do everything in his power to make the right decision, but he knows that sometimes he will fail, and he just has to be able to live with that.
Well, to me, that's one of the fascinating things about Kirk in the actual television series itself, is that Kirk didn't always make the right decision. Most of the time he did. But there were times where he made decisions that you could see on his face clearly weren't satisfying to him, that he thought, geez, could I have done this better? And the very first episode that ever aired... not the first one produced, was the Man Trap with the salt vampire or whatever. And at the end of that episode, you know, this is the last creature of its kind, and it's killing Enterprise crewmen, and so, you know, Kirk wants to kill this thing. But they talk about the buffalo, too, and how it was exterminated on Earth. And at the end of that episode, after the creature is killed, Kirk is melancholy and he says... I think McCoy, either Spock or McCoy, I think it's McCoy, asked him what he's thinking about. He said, I was just thinking about the buffalo. And it's clear that, you know, he wished that there had been a better resolution to this. I mean,
right.
There couldn't have been, but he wishes that there was. You know, in Errand of Mercy, he's arguing with the Organians that the Klingons and the Federation should be allowed to go to war. And then all of a sudden gets pretty sheepish when he realizes that he's arguing that they should be allowed to fight and kill millions of people. You know, Kirk, and in a private little war, he talks about he wants Scotty to manufacture flintlocks for villagers down on a planet to maintain a balance of power with the city people, then he says, you know, instead of flintlocks, he says, you know, serpents for the Garden of Eden. So clearly, there are decisions that he makes in the show that the character himself is not completely satisfied with, not completely sure that they're the right decisions. That, to me, is one of the things that makes Kirk a compelling character, that he's not superhuman. He's just human. But he's very introspective. He feels things a great deal. I think that's very important, that, you know, he doesn't take for granted the loss of his crewmen, especially in that first season. When the show first started, if you watch those early episodes, any time a red shirt ended up, you know, getting thrown off a cliff by Ruck, you know, and Kirk was, you know, he took some time, and you could see it on his face. It just ripped him apart. These are the things that are important to any sort of a leader, that he's trying to do the right thing. He thinks about the things not only that he's going to do, but that he has done. He's always examining his actions, both before and after the fact, and he cares deeply about the people that he's leading. I think it's what Gene Roddenberry was really after with Kirk. There's also this element of loneliness to command. You know, this terrible burden you have on your shoulders of, in Kirk's case, being responsible for the lives of 430 people in a dangerous environment. And that contributes to an air of loneliness, to an actual sort of lonely life. And, you know, in Naked Time, Kirk talks about, you know, he just wants some time off, no braid in his shoulder, you know, he wants a beach to walk on, those kinds of things. I try to be true to that. I tried to be true to the Kirk that we saw in the series. And those are all the things to me that make him a great character and a great leader.
We got to see some familiar aliens for the first time in this book, which I thought was awesome, the fact that Kirk is the first one to meet a Bajoran. Why did you choose the Bajorans and the Ascendants as the MacGuffin in this book?
Well, you know, I actually chose the Ascendants first. And I actually have a regret in about Allegiance and Exile, which is that I said that they were the Ascendants. I had some dialogue. I don't feel like that dialogue rings precisely true now. I wish I had just left them nameless, because you should be able to recognize them if you've been reading the books. But yeah, it's the time it seemed important to put their name out there. And then from that, it just sort of fell naturally that, oh, this should be the Bajorans. And I thought, wait a minute, do we know when we first encountered the Bajorans? Is there any story out there, in the any throwaway line in the series about when first contact was made, or how, or in any of the books? So I did a lot of research on that to make sure that that was the case, that wasn't the case, so that I could do it. And it was it was fun to do. I think it was, you know, a nice piece of Star Trek history to fill out, and it also kept the Ascendants. Even though we're in the past now, it still kept them front and center in a way, because I'm still hopeful that at some point we will see the Ascendant story. We've hinted at what's happened, but we don't know exactly what happened, and I would love to read that story. I would also love to write it, but certainly I would love to read it.
Yeah, I was really glad that you inserted them, because I felt like you just said, you know, it puts that in our minds again, and it gives the readership again, I think, a new hunger for, okay, can we please know what happened here in the Deep Space Nine storyline that you had set up so beautifully, and we were just waiting for the payoff.
Well, actually, I didn't set it up. Marco and you know, the writers prior to me set it up, and they set it up beautifully. So much so that I want to freaking read it.
Yeah, exactly. So if Pocket is listening, we want this story. We will make sure people buy it. And so David is willing to write it. So please let him do that.
I'm not the only one. You know, I really did face a dilemma with Rough Beasts of Empire and the 4-year gap. I could have just ignored it. I could have just not said a word about it, and I didn't say much, but it seemed to me that ignoring it would not have served anybody well, wouldn't have served storytellers well, wouldn't have served readers well. I don't think it would have been satisfying in any way, and I think giving it a couple of pages or even a chapter or two just would not have satisfied people, you know, which is why I chose the sort of middle ground, which is to hint at some of the things that happened, to say that, in fact, there was a resolution to this. We just don't know what it was. And I tried to make it not obvious, because, after all, Raik is now on Bajor. So wait a minute, what the heck happened?
Well, we've talked about a lot. You have an epic new series coming out with some of Trek's best authors. The 5-book series, yours is Revelations and Dust. It's going to be the kickoff for the fall, which also comes out in the fall, as we said. Any tidbits, any scoops we can get from you about, your newest entry, and that will be featuring the Deep Space Nine cast?
Well, you know, I'd love to read the first line of the story to you, but it's a spoiler, so I can't.
Okay.
If I read the first line, then it would spoil at least two or three different things, so I can't. But we will see the new Deep Space Nine, which is, you know, now a Starfleet facility, now an actual Corps of Engineer built, Miles O'Brien and Nog designed station. It's a little bit different than other star bases, Federation Starfleet star bases that we've seen. State of the art, should be fun. I'm looking forward to spending some time. Well, I've already spent some time there. I'm hopeful of spending more time there in the future. See if I kind of hints can I give. I don't know. You know, it's going to be an interesting series. I wonder how people are speculating about what, I mean, something called the fall kind of implies that something is going to, I don't know, fall. And I suspect that some people are worrying that it's the Federation. Some people are thinking it might be the Typhon Pact. I know that I know what's falling. And I think it's an interesting storyline. I think people will be satisfied with it. I couldn't be in better company than the writers that are following me. I mean, Una's a terrific writer, and Dave Mack and James Swallow, Dayton Ward, they're all great writers. And I actually just read Dayton's outline, and wow, just great stuff. Just from his outline, I was excited as a reader.
Yeah, I can't wait.
I think it, you know, I hope that it will, obviously I hope the entire series will satisfy everybody. I certainly hope my book will satisfy readers. It is, it does introduce the new Deep Space Nine, and it does, in some regard, try and pay respects to the 20th anniversary of Deep Space Nine's premiere. So I hope that will satisfy readers as well. And, I don't know what I can say. I've turned in the first draft. I'm waiting for the copy edits, and I'm rereading it right now myself just to make sure that everything hangs together.
Excellent.
Do you want to do it BSG style and read the final line of the book to us, and then we'll wonder, you know, where it's going?
Wow, if I read the final line of the book to you, that's an even bigger spoiler than the first one.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, you know, it was only within the last month or so that I wrote the last line, and I didn't know what the last line was going to be until shortly before that, but when I figured out what it was going to be, I got really excited, and I love the last line of this book. It's short, but it's good.
Good. Well, you know, you said it, the new station is going to be state of the art. I'm just hoping that everything's there by Tuesday when they need it. Cause we know how Starfleet kind of gets behind on things, you know.
Well, and there's, you know, it's been a while now, but there is, you know, 2381 was the early 2381 was the Borg invasion. So, Starfleet has been recovering for a while now. And that's part of the reason that they've allied with the Ferengi and the Cardassians as well, is because they need materiel. You know, they need ships. They need more ships. There's only so fast you can build a starship, and there's only so fast you can graduate new Starfleet classes. So it's been a hard 4 years for the Federation, for Starfleet in particular, since then. But, this we've seen a ship that doesn't get things till next Tuesday. We'll do something different with the new Deep Space Nine.
Sounds good. Well, the last thing that we always like to do for the authors is give them a chance to tell us about what's coming up next for them, plug anything that they want of theirs. This is your spot to just tell us what you're doing and where we can follow you and where, you know, the listeners can kind of get in touch with you. Just let us know.
I have a Facebook page that I interact with readers on, and that's DRGIII, facebook.com/DRGIII. And you can follow me on Twitter, which I just joined last month. You can follow me on Twitter at David R. George III. And I'm waiting for a contract for my next Star Trek novel, which should be here in the next couple of weeks. I know which series I'm doing. I know what I'm doing, but I can't really talk about it right now. I'm excited about it, though. And I have a couple other irons in the fire, but I'm not much of a salesman for myself. There's nothing really I can talk about right now. I can only say that I do have another Star Trek novel that'll be coming out in 2014.
Excellent.
Right now, I'm just excited about Allegiance in Exile, which just came out, and Revelation in Dust, which will be out in September, and then the following books by the other authors, which I'm looking forward to reading myself.
Great. Well, David, I really want to thank you so much for the time that you've given us. I mean, we have some of your works that we didn't get to cover here, but you've thankfully said that you would answer some questions in written form, so those will come out. So thank you so much for that, because you've written some amazing books, the Crucible series, which we didn't get to talk about here. And so, you know, if people are fans of, say, the original series, Allegiance in Exile is fantastic. If you haven't read the Crucible series, I think that that's definitely one of the highlights of the last 10 years in Trek Lit. And so, yes, I can't recommend personally your books more, because I have enjoyed every one that I've read.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I certainly feel privileged to be able to write these, and I'm glad that I love happy readers. So, and thank you for inviting me to chat with you. I appreciate it, Matt and Chris. It's been a lot of fun, and I will answer those questions on Crucible, so you'll have those for the website as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, David.
We really appreciate your time, David. It's been fantastic.
Thanks, guys.
Well, Matthew, that was a really fascinating interview there with David, and I'm glad that I could join you this time, because I like to hear firsthand what the authors have to say. And all the Deep Space Nine talk, of course, was, for me, brilliant.
Yeah, I'm so excited that David got a chance to come on and talk with us. You know, he's really has written some of my favorite Star Trek books, especially recently with Plagues of Night and Rays of the Dawn, really focusing on Deep Space Nine again. I was very excited that that happens.
All right. Well, Matthew, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on any of David's work or on the comics that we talked about at the beginning of the show in news. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Just choose to send a message to a show and choose Literary Treks, and that will come to Matthew and me. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. You can find us over on our new forums at trek.fm/forums, where there's a section devoted entirely to Literary Treks. And you can find us on Twitter under username trekfm. Matthew, what if people want to find you personally?
Well, if you do want to find me, of course, Doing the Book Reviews just reviewed David's newest book. It's on the website there, as well as we do the show The Orb, which we talk all Deep Space Nine all the time, you and I, Chris. So if you did like and enjoy the talk that we had about Deep Space Nine, join us there. As well as you can find me on Twitter, MattRushing02. I do try to keep it lively and fun, just tweeting about all sorts of things. So if you follow me, let me know, and we'll have a good conversation, hopefully.
You know, I'm just wondering, are you a Vorta by any chance? Is MattRushing03 going to suddenly appear in my timeline one day?
How did you know? You've blown my cover, Chris. Ah, Matt.
I've been trying to figure
Matt
it out.
Rushing
I've been trying to figure out what this O2 means.
Yeah. Matt Rushing 01 was so lame. Matt Rushing 02 is much better.
Yeah.
Our illustrious Matt Rushing 03, I think, will be fantastic. So we'll see. Where can we find you, Chris?
If you want to find me, I'm on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username. And you can find me, besides The Orb, you can also find me every week on The Ready Room with Craig Harbin, where we do Star Trek news and go through all 5 of the live action series, as well as the movies and a few special topics here and there with a whole panel to discuss those. So join us over there.
We do want to say a special thanks to all of you who have reviewed us on iTunes, given us a review there, star review, or also given us a written review. Thank you for that. If you haven't, we would love that you would do that for us. It does help people find the show. A few of our shows have made it into the new and noteworthy section, and that just helps people see the show, find the show, listen to it, and definitely contact us. Let us know the things that you're thinking about the show, especially on the forums. It's very important to us, and we love getting to hear from you all who listen, and the things that you might want to hear about too. That's also what we're there for. And we want to say to all the listeners, live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.